watching a movie about Porgy and babies. Goo goo, yeah.
Not babies, babysitters.
Mommy and Daddy are watching a movie about babysitters. And Porgy babysitters and poetry. Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Why, hello.
Welcome to He Saw, She Saw.
If you're just joining us, I am Keith.
And I am Corey.
And we love movies.
Just not the same ones.
So we make each other watch a movie that we love.
But the other has no interest in, has never seen, or would never even see, unless they were forced to because of a podcast.
And then we talk about it.
And this week is all about death.
Yep, we wanted to have something nice and exciting for everybody, nice and happy. So, yeah.
So death. But you know, in fun and in inventive ways, really.
Well, in at least one of the cases, yes.
So, I am having Keith watch Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter is Dead, which I adore this movie. Like I said last time, I had the poster on my wall. I went out and bought a black halter top and tried to imitate the look of Miss Christina Applegate. I love Christina Applegate. I used to watch her on Married with Children. I teach at a summer theater program every mm-hmm. year at La Jolla Playhouse. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a group of about six teachers. My dear friend Courtney and I, we figured out early on that we shared that love for this movie. So we've got interns that are like children wranglers, and then we've got office interns. So we trained our office interns to say whatever we asked for something, like Post-its. And I asked for a lot of Post-its because when I am creating theater pieces with children, Post-its is my go-to medium. Mm-hmm. And so we trained them to say, "I'm right on top of that, Rose," which you will get after you watch the movie. But
will I, though?
You will.
For shame, I didn't realize how truly funny Christina Applegate was until Anchorman. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just because I'd only seen her on Married with Children, and, you know, she was beautiful and kind of funny, but I just was like, okay, yeah, whatever. So I've never seen this one.
Well, and you don't like situations.
Uncomfortable situations, that's true.
So it just probably sounded like just a lot of uncomfortable situations.
Yeah.
This movie taught me about petty cash also. So what great masterpiece do I get to watch?
Well, this one actually, most people would argue, is a masterpiece. So, so early movie for me, when I was like in my teens, that I just thought was amazing was Dead Poets Society. Mm-hmm. And so it includes Josh Charles in both movies.
Yes.
And it took us a while to realize, oh, yeah, they both say dead in the title. But the death in Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, it's like a comedic hook. Death in this movie, I mean, it's a rumination in many ways about what does it mean to live. And so it's going to be a very complete 180, I'd imagine.
Well, actually, I don't think so, because that is what Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead is about, is what is it like to truly live?
Yeah, your eyebrows are moving, so I think that might be. I love the movie. I don't usually watch serious movies over and over and over again, and I haven't seen this one in a long time. So maybe even since the theater. I might have only seen it once.
But another one-er.
Yeah, but it was absolutely spectacular. So
yeah, I just don't like serious movies in general.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you are crying.
I don't like
You're not crying. You're crying in this movie. So we're gonna get some Kleenex, so we'll be ready
like
to go.
Like crying like the Bob Ross documentary that I watched the other night and tried to hide that I was crying by folding up a blanket and putting it over my face.
I think it's cute you ever think that you are hiding that you're crying. Yes, it is going to.
I think you even heard me go.
I think this is going to be like, I'm not even going to try to hide it. Just, you know, our daughter looking over and saying, "Is mom watching something again?" Like, I'm guessing that's what's going to happen here with Dead Poets Society.
All right. Well, let's laugh at death and then cry about it.
Yeah. Why not?
So 1991, I was in a grade in middle school, or junior high, as we called it. Why are you laughing?
I'm not going to say how old I am. I'm just going to narrow it down to like 2 years. So
middle school's like 3 years.
One of the things I didn't do in 1991 is watch this movie.
I watched it so many times. So, all of the times.
Really? So I'm guessing it held up.
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, I have to make a little confession. I have watched it within the last year because we were in quarantine. And it's a comfort movie for me. And it was all on HBO Max. And you got me HBO Max as a gift so that I could watch I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which I thank you for.
You're very welcome.
And a plethora of other docu-series, as well as stand-up specials.
Yep.
Gotta have the stand-up specials.
So feel free to sponsor us, HBO Max. We appreciate it.
I still love this movie, although I will admit that there are some things that I didn't understand when I was younger that I realize now is because it was poorly
there was a couple executed. Times a couple times I looked over at you like really huh okay
I did have a couple of realizations. I always wondered, like, that's really weird, like, bedspread and room that she has, and then I realized today watching this she took over her mom's room.
That's what I thought the clothing montage was for earlier. So
but yes, it some of the things were problematically written. But so what? I love the movie. Do you have a pitch for this movie?
I really should have written it ahead of time, but I think I'm going to go with a recent high school graduate has to take care of her family when she finds out the babysitter is dead.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically what the title is.
There you go. No spoiler.
The expanded title.
No spoiler. So it starts off with Sue Ellen. What was her last
name? Crandall.
Crandall, Sue Ellen Crandall, and her nickname's going to be Swell, which I don't think is the typical nickname for Sue Ellen, and they never explain it, but it was, a weird nickname.
Over and over again, Swell, Swell, and they even write it out, Swell, Swell.
Yeah.
Like, not Sue-L, S-W-E-L, Swell.
We open with her and with a bunch of her high school friends, and we establish they've just graduated, and all the girls are going on this trip to Europe, except for Christina Applegate's character, Swell. But she isn't that broken up because her mom's boyfriend is taking mom to Australia. So she doesn't get to go to Europe. But to Swell, the concept of having a summer of just having fun is on the horizon without mom. So she's excited. So we go home to where she's going to stay. And this place is just a wreck. Like, I think Kurt Russell's character from Overboard would, like, look at this and say, oh, man, that's a mess. Like, it is just a ridiculous, it's a great big house.
My hat is off to the set decorator.
Oh, my gosh.
That must have been so fun.
Oh, my gosh. It is such a mess. It gave me anxiety, and I am not a super clean, organized person. Mm-mm. We meet the brood. And so we have five kids in this family. So we have Sue Ellen, who just graduated from high school. We have sibling number two. Is Keith Coogan, who plays a stoner loser named Kenny. And Kenny is just like everything you do not want your high school son to be. He is just a complete unapologetic pothead, does not listen, does not care, does whatever he wants, and complains at every opportunity. And then the middle kid is just this sensitive... Like, you know, I guess he's supposed to be a ladies' man, but he's just like a lovesick. He's into
like
a girl.
Ladies' man.
Yeah, so he's like 13, 12 or 13. And then we have sibling number four is a Tom girl. And then the youngest one is Wally, and he is 8-ish to 10-ish.
He's got a bull haircut.
He got a bull haircut, and he's obsessed with TV. Yes. Seems like a nice kid. And we also have a corgi. We have a corgi named Elvis, who does not get nearly enough screen time. I was very disappointed.
But there was three dog wranglers trainers, but he didn't do a whole lot.
Yeah.
He had act stoned.
Yeah. So we established that the mom has, like, basically zero control.
No control.
The entire house is an absolute mess. Like, literally, I don't remember if we have mold in the first kitchen scene, but definitely in subsequent, we have obvious mold with flies. And so Christina can't kick mom out of the door quick enough.
Yeah.
She just like, it's okay, just leave.
And she's like smoking, no big deal. And Kenny has a tattoo. So yeah.
Yeah. The mom is just overwhelmed. And I've just got to say, I get it, you know? So, I mean, it
can you imagine five?
All single parents out there, you're amazing.
Hats off.
Yeah. So as she's about to leave, suddenly an old lady in a very cool car pulls up.
And be like,
she's just a sweet old lady, and she kind of comes up, and Christina Applegate Swell is just so upset that they have a babysitter. But it doesn't matter, because Kenny's already gone. He took off. Mom leaves, and as soon as she leaves, this sweet old lady just turns into a witch.
She's a good actress.
She pops out a whistle, and they do every trope of like mean old lady who's not going to put up with anything. It does not work for long because the kids are fed up with everything, and we got a lot of gags I won't go through on just how
she does a lot of stuff to the kids.
Yeah, right away. So the kids have had enough, and so they burst into the room and find out that she's dead.
Remember what happened to her right before she died? She went into Kenny's room, and that gave her a panic attack, and that killed her.
Debatable, but okay. We have this dead woman, and so the kids are like, oh, man, I don't know what to do. If we call the police or the hospital, then they're going to come in, and then they'll take care of the body for us, but then they're going to ask a question, and then we'll be the prime suspects, and then the worst thing they're more concerned about is Mom will come home. So they stuff the lady into an old, like, you know, like kind of treasure trunk and drop it off at the front door of a mortuary. And there's a note on this trunk that says, nice old lady
inside
died of natural causes. And so they're feeling a little guilty, but not really, because they've got a new car now and they go home. As they're trying to figure out, you know, like, it's like, okay, so we need to ration out the money and figure out how we're going to make this work.
Their mom left an envelope of cash.
Yeah.
For the whole summer.
Small problem. There's no money. 2 months of groceries was on the lady's person and, you know, they didn't pat her down, which again, I don't blame them for. So the problem is, where are we going to get money? Christina Applegate will go get a job. And then Kenny's going to be on mommy duty.
Mommy duty, yeah.
So Swell goes to a place that I would consider probably the second ring of hell. I'm not sure. She's working at Clown Dog. And it is just kind of like a 1950s greasy spoon catering to like young families and kids.
Lots of circus, clown circus.
Yeah. And of course, Christina's having to do all these gross food service type things. And so she's not even done with the first day. It's like late at night. She's having to clean up, and it's just a huge mess. And the only nice thing about this job is there's a delivery boy who is played by Josh Charles, and his name is Brian. So they talk, kind of flirting just a little bit. It's just, it's a horrible job. So
she's complaining to him.
She's complaining. He's like, well, why don't you quit? And she said, huh. And the manager comes back, who is just a ton of overacting. And Swell says, yeah, I quit. And says to Brian, hey, thanks for the advice, and just takes off.
See you around.
Well, she's like, well, I want a job I want. And so she looks in the newspaper classifieds.
Which is something we used to do.
Which actually was a thing. And finds a huge ad for a receptionist at a fashion firm. So she puts together a resume. And by put together a resume, I mean she literally takes a resume book and types everything that's there. Ridiculously overqualified.
Yeah.
And shows up to say, okay, I'm here for the job. Now, the receptionist is a woman named Carolyn, who's just a little bit older than Christina Applegate. And just
she's
just a witch.
You know? She talks like she's chewing her face.
She's rude to Christina Applegate's character, and she just kind of like goes, okay. She's just brushing off, kind of biting her tongue. And Carolyn needs to go do something real quick. And so this woman named Rose walks up to the front desk. Swell kind of charms her and says, yeah, I'm here for the receptionist position. And so Rose grabs the resume, which is highly falsified, and says, are you kidding me? I just lost my executive assistant, and Caroline is supposed to be moving into being my assistant. I just want to hire you. And so she just gets a job.
This is the classic 90s. Like, I just fall into this. I don't think it'll work.
Swell is excited. She's treating the kids to Chuck E. Cheese. But the small problem is she's like, we're running out of money, and I've got a job which will pay me, but I don't know what to do in the meantime.
Because she gets, doesn't get paid.
Yeah, you have to wait 2 weeks. They walk out of Chuck E. Cheese at the end, like after closing time. Like, I'm sure the people at Chuck E. Cheese hated them because they were like the last people in the parking lot. Mm-hmm. And we have three drag queens.
Liza.
Marilyn, and I don't know who the other one. So they lose to these drag queens, their car. And so they're stuck because all of Swell's friends are in Europe. All of Kenny's friends are losers. And so who do they call but Brian? So Brian shows up.
From Clown Dog.
From Clown Dog in the delivery van, which is just horrible.
Which is kind of like the Dumb and Dumber like dog van, but
yeah,
but
not. Without the fur.
Without the fur,
right? Yeah,
but like a clown nose.
So he's the knight in shining armor. He picks him up and takes him home, and he's having a nice conversation with Swell outside the house. Mm-hmm. And her four siblings are just ruining the inside, and they're
screaming.
And one of them yells that they don't have any food. And so Brian's like, "You guys really don't have any food? Mm-hmm. I've got these extras from the delivery that I couldn't deliver. You guys just take them." Mm-hmm. And so like, he's already made her swoon now. Like he saved her twice, and so he asks her out very clumsily on a date, and she semi-clumsily says yes.
So we figure out really quick that this is not the fashion paradise that Swell thought she was working at. They literally make like uniforms mm-hmm. for like different companies and so on and so forth. And we learn the most important thing is that if Rose is ever in the middle of something and asks Swell a question, she is supposed to answer right on top of that, Rose.
Ah-ha!
And so that is, Swell is over her head, but she says she's a quick learner.
Well,
and so she's
like early 90s office like equipment stuff.
Yeah,
that's happening.
So it's like written by like people who I don't know if they really spent much time in an office, but but yeah, so I mean, but and she's also, so she basically figures out one of the tenets of making work, which mm-hmm. is you avoid the incompetent people mm-hmm. and then you work with the people who are competent. And so she very quickly figures that out, and she's having that one of the incompetent people is actually Rose's current boyfriend, who's named Gus, played by John Getz, I think, mm-hmm. who's just like...
Oh, he's just got slime dripping
He's
off
just
him.
A pedo from the jump. Like, oh. He is just like, he's like one of those people who's like, okay, you've killed a hooker. Anyway.
Because the dog's eating again. Hold on.
Hey, could you chew a little quieter?
No. Okay.
Okay.
Hopefully you won't be able to hear it.
So... She finds out that she has access to petty cash as the assistant to Rose's character. And so she's like, oh, so she's now solved her money issue mm-hmm. because she's like, okay, I'll just take out the money I need.
I'll just put it back.
And then I'll just put it back when I get paid. Mm-hmm. So
I'm gonna get like $1,000.
In the midst of this, the Gus character basically tells her, hey, you want to go out to lunch? And very quickly, totally hits on her. He would just say these horrible things and say, I'm just kidding, though, if you're not into it.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not into it, I'm just kidding. Yeah, so she doesn't realize it at first, but by the end of the lunch, she's like, oh, okay, got it. The other thing that makes things complicated is Carolyn, the receptionist, who's mad at mm-hmm. Swell's character for taking her job, mm-hmm. is the older sister of Brian.
Dun, dun, dun.
So the issue is, this makes things difficult, because Swell has already had a date or so with mm-hmm. Brian. We very quickly established, like, okay, these guys are meant to be together. They work. They make sense. Mm-hmm. But she's got to be super secretive of, like, her job and, like, avoiding his family.
She's lying.
Because she's flat out lying. And so this causes a big issue. And he's just thinking that she's seeing another guy or seeing someone else.
Because she keeps acting weird. Like, he'll ask, he's like, oh, do you want to go to a Dodgers game? Yeah. Oh, cool. My sister got these tickets. Oh, I just remembered I hate baseball.
Yeah, the thing that we establish is that she's avoiding these things. He's heartbroken, but he's kind of done. He's just like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
So not only do we have this breakup, her younger siblings keeps rifling through the petty change, the petty cash. And so they make thousands of dollars in debt. They go through like $3,000 buying mm-hmm. just stupid over the top things.
Because
and
they're
then,
taking money out of her purse.
Yes. And then what happens is that we find out that this company has just lost another big account. And so they're going to be going under. Everything's exploding on Swell. She has a brainstorm because she's on the factory floor looking at all these uniforms. And so she starts to piece a plan together. And so she tells Rose, and Rose is like, this could work. We could make this happen.
She's solving a fashion emergency.
So they're creating this big event. And to also help cover the petty cash
that she took,
they decide to have the event at Swell's house, or her family's house.
Remember the condition we said the house was in?
Yeah. So... This is the, if this was an action movie, this would be the montage of training. Yeah. And so basically Kenny, who has had a lot of cheap munchy jokes throughout the whole movie, is like suddenly becoming this amazing chef. And then all the siblings like are actually start like, you know, mowing lawns and cleaning stuff and so on and so forth. So we get to the big event at the house.
Which
and
is gonna be a fashion show.
which is going to be this huge fashion show. We have all these buyers here. The house looks so much better, although still you wouldn't do a fashion show. No. But it's going incredibly well. And like everyone's grown up is basically what's happened. Mm-hmm. And then
we all work together.
At the peak of the fashion show, the heartsick Brian shows up in the clown dog car with like, you know, on the radio, having like a rambling, like try to be a say anything moment.
It's like there's obviously something going on at the house. What are you doing?
Yeah, what are you doing? There's just like so many cars there. And so he's just going, pouring out his heart. And then he pulls up to the backyard. Swell just acts like this is one of our new uniforms.
This is the coup de grace of the fashion show.
And Brian has no idea what's going on. And then, of course, mom shows up. Mm-hmm. So we have the heartfelt speech of Swell saying, like, I'm so sorry. I'm 17. I'm not ready for any of this.
I lied to all of you. I'm sorry, I can't do this.
She doesn't quite rush off, but she basically, mom is like, you're in big trouble, young lady. And that's what, which was so.
When I was younger, I didn't get that. I was like, obviously, this isn't like a house party with stupid teenagers. The house is the best it's probably ever looked. There's all these fancy people. It's obviously a fancy, like, event. Would you yell out, you're in big trouble, Missy?
I would be very like, what the heck is going on? I might not in the middle of it.
It's a fashion show to me. Like, maybe, what if Sewell had, like, rented the house out? I wouldn't have done that. That would embarrass me. I would have pulled my child aside.
I'm glad this is getting recorded. So anyway, so mom shows up. She's very upset. And Sewell takes her to the kitchen and says, you just need to rest. And we'll talk about it tomorrow. And I'm really sorry. I know we need to talk this out, but it's not what you think.
Yeah.
And everything's going to be okay.
The roles have quite reversed.
I saw it more as of a more of an equality type thing, mm-hmm. where it's like, oh, my kid has grown up. And her stoner son, mm-hmm. you know, actually has completely changed. He's cut his hair. So we have that. So we have the talk with the mom. It's like, okay, things are going to be okay. And then we talk to Rose. And she's like, I'm so sorry about the lying. Throughout this entire movie, Rose has been in Swell's corner. Mm-hmm. And she's like, it's fine. They actually, I've got so many leads. The buyers loved it. Thank you so much. And basically, could you still work for me? Swell's like, I think I want to go to college. I don't know.
Which I didn't get when I was younger either. I was like, oh my God, you can totally skip over all that and get a job? Do it.
Yeah. What's wrong with you? Well, it was the early 90s where everybody had to go to college if they were supposedly going to do anything. Mm-hmm. We hadn't figured out the whole compound interest and the debt and all that stuff yet. And then she goes up to Brian, and Brian is like, look, I was just talking to my sister, and I think we've figured out everything. Is there anything else I need to know? They established like, aw, they're gonna date. And then we have what I think is one of my favorite lines ever in a movie for its placement. Because in the midst of all this, we finally have the mom saying, wait a second, where's the babysitter? And that's basically the end of the movie. So as the credits roll, we go back to the funeral home. Mm-hmm. And we have the two guys who had picked up the body. And they're standing in front of a gravestone. And they're both being solemn. I'm like, man, I'm going to miss her. And the gravestone says, nice lady who died of natural causes.
Inside. And nice lady inside.
And so that was the movie. So some of the things that I liked, mm-hmm. I was just completely blown away by Christina Applegate's performance. She was 18 mm-hmm. when that movie was filmed.
It was her first lead.
And she had done Married with Children for a while, and I'm sure she had done a few other things, small things before. But to be an 18-year-old with that much confidence, mm-hmm. and articles I read before and the articles I read when she was discussing this movie, this sounds like that's her real personality, not the immature Swell mm-hmm. that we saw, but the moments of her pretending to be an adult. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like Christina Applegate was just really professional, really smart. I really liked how the script didn't get too cutesy mm-hmm. on how she was fooling people. Mm-hmm. Also, they weren't relying on her looks. Yeah, she was young. Yeah, she was pretty. Mm-hmm. But they really established that she was competent. She was responsible. Mm-hmm. You know, it was written, essentially they were kind of aiming for Winona Ryder.
Really?
To play that role. I think that if they had known they were writing it for Kelly Bundy, I think it would have been much different. I think it would have been a much worse movie. Uh-huh. The Kenny character I disliked, but... Yeah, but Keith Coogan does have, he had more natural chemistry, I think, in this movie than other movies I've seen him in. And I've seen him in a few other movies. I really liked him. Mm-hmm. His character is the one that changes the most.
Mm-hmm. You but know? It's very, I don't know, he just does the Bill and Ted laugh, you know? Like he's yeah. just...
What's interesting is that he originally read for the part of Brian.
Oh.
And he didn't feel like it went well. And, and the funny thing was, is that he was workshopping some characters like a
stoner dude.
Like stoner dudes, basically like a Wayne's World is basically yeah, what he was doing.
That's yeah.
Since he had the props in his car.
In his car.
He put on the skull jacket.
The bad wig.
He put on the wig and he burst back in there in character and said, hey, who do you, because he wanted to read for the
Kenny.
So he said like he got on the spot, but I'm sure they were like, all right. And then a big change.
When I was younger, I didn't buy him as a stoner because I also remembered all the other things that he had done.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where the other characters kind of ruined that. But I have a feeling that if you didn't have that picture of him at first, it'd be like, oh, okay, I can kind of see that. Other things, like just the animation in the beginning was really good. I was really shocked.
Oh.
For 91. And I thought it was hilarious in the credits to find out that Homer Simpson did the voice of the
Dan Castellaneta.
Old lady. In the beginning, so
that annoyed me back then when movies would start with an animation sequence.
It was much better than your normal animation sequence. So yeah. At the time,
that was a thing for a while.
Yeah, I thought overall it was a good script. They make a big deal about how HBO put it in heavy rotation, and actually mm-hmm. HBO financed the movie at first, mm-hmm. so it didn't make up the movie money at first, evidently, and so they kept playing it, right. And evidently it just became a staple for so many people. That's why it's such a cult classic today.
Well, I sure watched him the heck out of it.
There were several monstrous plot holes. I'm not from LA, but I have no way of knowing where the heck she could have lived. Because,
right.
Like,
to make it to work on time?
One, the house is like...
Well, they're in the boonies, they say.
Yeah, they're like in a 5-bedroom house.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, like...
Like, with land.
Like, yeah, it's...
And no neighbors.
Yeah, it's like, it's not like something you normally see in California. Like, there's yeah. no, like, there's no fences. Like,
right.
the fact that the clown car can make it to the backyard.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like, I don't know.
Like Ramona.
Yeah, Ramona or Hamul or Oregon. You know, it just didn't make any...
Ramona, Hamul, or Oregon.
I'm normally a fan of David Duchovny, and he does a fine job in this role, but it was very a peripheral part. So one of these peripheral parts is we have Carolyn and David Duchovny trying to get Christina Applegate's character to expose her. Ixwell leaves her purse at work on the top of her desk, and so they break into her office like 11 at night, and they open up the purse. In her wallet, they see an ID which says that she's 17. And it's like, how the heck do you forget a purse? And so that made no sense. And of course, it's a running theme on this podcast, but...
Oh, what? There was no amnesia.
They have no idea how business works. So we have the fashion show, which, you know, you wouldn't have it at the house. Especially, you're not going to have it in the boonies.
Mm-mm.
The ending of the fashion event was not subtle. She got on the mic and explained she was 17 and had just lied to them all.
But Keith, they don't care. They just were wild for the design that she came up with.
And that was
for the nurse costume.
Crazy, because I should have said earlier, the big thing to save everything was you basically merge 90s fashion with uniforms. The idea that all the buyers would be like, oh, you hire a 17-year-old and have them produce everything.
They liked it because she got a 17-year-old's perspective.
We know that she didn't intentionally go get a 17-year-old's perspective because the 17-year-old went on the microphone to yell that she had lied to all of them. So I think the charisma of Christina Applegate is crucial to the success of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think Keith Coogan, was crucial to the success.
He was funny. The thing that I noticed, they kept saying, oh, we don't have any more food. That's the last scrap of food. We don't have any more food. But then there kept being food. When they had absolutely no food left, it was Monday morning and she was getting ready to go to her job. Mm-hmm. They're like, I realize it was a gag, but they should have done it later because the kids are sitting around and they're like, we're hungry. And so she goes and gets a punch bowl and she fills it with an entire box of Captain Crunch and an entire carton of milk. But there wouldn't be a full carton of milk with a stoner teenager.
Yeah, yeah, especially four or five of them.
And a full thing of Captain Crunch. I didn't realize how soundtrack heavy. I don't think there is a scene that does not have some sort of score or soundtrack under it. I was so irritated this time around. I was like, okay, we get it. Jeez, like so much like rock, you know, music. Basically, like the song is saying exactly what the scene is about, you know?
Wow. Okay, yeah.
And the other thing that I love, we didn't even talk about the dishes are done, man. That's such an iconic like line.
Yeah, from the like it was all over the commercials. Like that was I knew that line before.
Yeah, everyone does. I really loved how they make Swell and Kenny kind of like turn into little mini adults. They have very adult conversations and complaints and you know, when was the last time we had dinner together?
Yeah, yeah. I mean that's one of the themes of the movie is the kids are very capable. Mm-hmm. You know, when they decide they want to be. So when it comes to my rating for this movie.
Yes.
I think that I started double thumbs down.
Mm-hmm. No secret.
Yeah. And when it came down to it, I put one thumb in the middle. Uh-huh. Because there were some kind of issues.
Plot holes.
Plot holes with the movie that were very,
I agree.
Very blatant. It's not like super iconic. It isn't super over the top, mm-hmm. like what I consider like a double thumbs up. Mm-hmm. But I definitely do have a thumbs up for it.
You do?
Because yeah, it is especially with Christina Applegate.
Yeah.
It's a great movie to like have on in the background and mm-hmm. to see at least once. So I definitely think that it's a good movie that's worth seeing. But it's not cool. Double thumbs up. But
I mean, I get it. This movie was not made for you.
Mm-hmm.
However, funny movie.
It has its moments. should I get a clown dog car? Is that and go over the loudspeaker? How much I love you?
And, no, it's okay.
Okay.
But I would like you to get a classic wedge cap.
Oh wow!
I always was under the impression that Robin Williams was a comedian first, mm-hmm. turned actor. And I guess I never like looked into it, but mm-hmm. he actually went to Juilliard.
He did.
And studied acting. I've always been really impressed by him. And I think part of that was because I was like, oh, he's a comedian. Because mm-hmm. when I was younger, like I knew him from Mork and Mindy. And then, you know, his stand-up specials where he was like on cocaine.
Yeah. What was it? Comic Relief? That was one of my big introductions to Robin Williams.
So, Keith.
Yes.
Did this movie hold up for you?
It totally did. This is my third time watching it. What's really interesting, when I watched it the first time, I couldn't help but be in the position of the students. Mm-hmm. And then this time watching
this time.
I couldn't help but be in the situation of Robin Williams. Mm-hmm. And so it was a movie that really affected me as a youngster. Mm-hmm. But now I, you know, especially directly as a teacher, it's like, am I doing enough for the kids? Mm-hmm. You know, if the kids aren't different after having me as a teacher, then what the heck am I doing?
So my pitch for this movie, mm-hmm. and I think you're going to be really proud of me.
Okay.
An unorthodox English teacher inspires his students to become free thinkers and to seize the day.
Ah.
And I won't tell you what happens when they do.
Nice. Thank you. I was about to say that first sentence is perfect.
We start off in, I think it's New England. It's a mm-hmm. boarding school. They call it a preparatory academy, which made me laugh. So it's like in the 1950s, mm-hmm. and we're in orientation day. And mm-hmm. I just was like, I can't even imagine being dropped off or dropping my child off to live at a school away from me. No, thank you.
Yeah.
Like,
especially with how young some of the kids are.
Some of the kids are so young. You know, there was like elementary school kids.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you raise your kid if they're at a school? You're not, I can't even.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is you don't. The school raises your kid for you.
Yeah.
So
there'd be no way I would drop our child off. After their little opening ceremonies, and we learn that Robin Williams, who plays Mr. Keating, is going to be the new English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
After that whole thing, we meet the gang. Mm-hmm. I call them the bad boys of biology because they're the study group. Like, uh-huh. they're so cool and so crazy in the study group. So we meet Neil. We meet Knox, Meeks, Pitts, Dalton. They're all part of that study group, and there's a new guy, and his name is Todd. He's an interesting character. He's not sure of himself. He's a bit jumpy. I think he might have dyslexia or a stutter or something. His older brother went to this school and was like a star, and so his parents are shipping him off and expecting him to follow in the footsteps, and so he doesn't really know who he is. It's funny because, you know, these guys, they think they're so big and bad and cool and whatever, and it just made me laugh because it reminded me of, so as I mentioned before, I teach at a theater program during the summertime, and we get all the kids that are invisible in real life, or like, you know, bullied or whatever. And so it's funny because you just, to watch these kids, they show up and they come every year. You know, I was there 9 summers. And so I watched a lot of these kids grow up. And they are the king of the hill when they come to the summer program. They are just having the time of their lives. Like for, you know, 6 weeks in the summer, they get
Well, they've got these incredible actors and dancers and singers who pour their lives into them for 6 weeks. I mean, you know.
So that's kind of what it reminded me of. It reminded me of like, okay, you're so big and bad at studying Latin. So Todd Anderson, as I said, played by Ethan Hawke. He's the new kid. And I feel like he kind of just wanted, he's like how I would be. Like, look, I'm at this new school. Like, I'm fine. Just leave me alone. I don't need to make friends. But his bunkmate, Neil, Neil is assigned to him. And Neil is just kind of like the star of the school at this point. And he really wants to include him, whether Todd wants to be included or not. Neil's dad shows up. Neil's dad's played by Kurtwood Smith, who is the dad in the 70s show. And he is the same always age.
Yeah, him and Paul Rudd. It's just he got his elixir later in life.
He tells Neil, you know, I think you have too many extracurriculars, and I think that you need to drop the annual. And Neil's like, I'm editing the annual. And
yeah, assistant like, editor. Yeah.
He's like, no, you need to drop it and don't question me. And he's like, okay, fine. We kind of establish that like his dad is very authoritarian and very involved in the minutia of Neil's life, because Neil is doing really well in his classes, but his father, you know, he wants him to go to Harvard and he wants him to become a doctor, and there's nothing that's going to get in the way of that. And something like an annual is a silly thing that doesn't need to be done. We follow them through the first day of school, and there's a lot of straight-laced authoritarian teachers assigning a lot of homework, like right away. It's business as usual, except for Mr. Keating's English class. He has them all get up and follow him into the hallway. He tells them basically to look at the faces of all of the former classmates that are in the display cases of the hallway. He tells them to seize the day, because all the students that you're looking at right here are now fertilizing daffodils. And I thought that is truly haunting coming from Robin Williams' mouth.
Yeah, it was funny. With my Slavic heritage, it wasn't until I moved to Russia and studied there, it was the first time that I was looking at pictures of people who were like 200 years old, who are like, that could be me. Like, you see yourself staring back, and these guys are long gone. And so it's a haunting experience.
So that made me kind of emotional. Not as emotional as I am right now, though. Funny enough.
Yeah, you held it together at the watching it.
Yeah, but I think it's because I knew what to expect, and I knew it was coming, and I knew it was going to try to make me cry, so it didn't really affect me. So at the end of the day, they're like, oh, that was really weird. Okay, he's a little unorthodox.
But he's a former star student as well, which is one of the things that kind of gives him the leeway. It's like, oh,
he's a Rhodes Scholar.
Yeah, this guy was brilliant, and he did the same thing that we did.
We learned that Knox, who's played by Josh Charles, he will not be joining study group tonight because he has to go to dinner with the Danburys. And the Danburys are alumni. He shows up at the Danburys' house. And Chris, the most beautiful woman he's ever seen in this life, opens the door. But she's just there visiting Chet, who is their son. So he meets her, and he's like, oh, comes back to the school. Everyone's, in full swing of the study group. So he's like, oh, I just met the most beautiful girl in the world, and I love her. And so then they're at school, and again, they're in Mr. Keating's class. And Mr. Keating has them open up their books to the introduction of literature, and there's a 20-page essay written by a professor describing how you can rate the quality of a poem by doing a math problem. And he tells them all to rip out that introduction out of their textbooks. And of course, they're just like, what? And so then they rip a page out. He's like, rip it all out, rip it out. So Neil, he knows that Mr. Keating was a former student of Welton Academy, or Helton, as they call it. And so he finds Mr. Keating's annual.
Because, of course, he used to be the assistant editor for the annual, so it makes sense for him to look it up.
Poor Neil. And he discovers the Dead Poets Society. And this is, he learns from Mr. Keating, the scandalous group that met in a cave and read Thoreau, Whitman, and Shelley to each other. You know, the biggies. And Mr. Keating is like, ugh, burn that thing. Mm-hmm. And so Neil decides that, hey, we should start this group up again. Neil tries to get Todd to agree to go as well, but Todd doesn't really want to go. He says he doesn't really want to go, doesn't really want to read. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, you know, it's fine. You can come. Like, you don't have to read. They make him go. Mm-hmm. They drag him there anyway.
And we also see in the group, we start to see the dynamics. Like, Neil's the leader. One kid with red hair. What's that?
That's Richard.
Yeah.
He's the one that, in the very beginning, they ask if it's okay if Richard joins the group because he's roommates with Dalton. So he's kind of was on the periphery before, mm-hmm. and so he's kind of a newer member.
And he's a total rule follower, wet blanket, mm-hmm. you know, which will become important later.
Mm-hmm. And so they sneak into the cave, they read poetry to each other, they tell ghost stories, they look at pinups, and they rap.
Yeah, kind of. It's the director. He was trying to recreate this idea of like kind of a pagan, like pre-Christian mm-hmm. existence.
Well, it did look very pagan. So Keating then goes on. He's teaching Shakespeare to them. He then does the thing that he always does in movies where he runs schizophrenically through all types of different characters. But mm-hmm. this time he's using Shakespeare. Plays and lines to do it, and mm-hmm. The boys dig it. And then he tells them that they need to look at things from a different point of view. And the minute you think that you know something, hold on, the dog's drinking.
Water break.
Our last. Okay, we're all taking a water break. When I was trying to listen to Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, there was a whole section of eating and drinking mm-hmm. from the dog that I couldn't cut it out. So, mm-hmm. Yes, I do know. Maybe that'll be like a little Easter egg for all of you. Is that, did you hear the eating and drinking? So anyway, so where was I? He tells them that just when you think that you know something, you need to look at it from a different point of view. And so he stands up on his desk. And so he's like, get up here. Everyone needs to come up and stand up on this desk and take a look from a different point of view.
He establishes in the very first scene, too, that they can call him two things. You can either call him Mr. Keaton or you can call him, oh, Captain, my Captain. Mm-hmm. And so he very much kind of runs them through different drills that you wouldn't normally do in a classroom. But again, he's the captain, so they can mm-hmm. they do whatever he's...
It's kind of funny. I'm gonna talk about this now. I was going to talk about it later. But it seemed to me Mr. Keating only had that one class.
Yeah, which is kind of a weakness of the movie. They kind of split the difference. Like, he's very specifically teaching poetry.
Right. But, and the other thing with his teaching methods is that, like, that's what they push you to do as a teacher now. They're pushing for you to build engagement with students. And so, yeah, get them up out of their chairs and get them, you know, I've done lessons where we're marching and lessons where we are standing on things and crawling around on the floor. And that was just, you know, English class. Mm-hmm. So not just my drama classes. I was very comfortable watching all of that. I was like, well, yeah, that's what you do. The boys start seizing the day all over the place. They're carpe DMing everywhere. Neil decides that he is going to audition for Midsummer Night's Dream, and he actually gets the part. He's going to play Puck, which Midsummer Night's Dream is a really fun play to do. I've never done the whole play. I've done, like, scenes from the play for classes and stuff, and I always get to play Hermia because she's the small one, mm-hmm. and she's very feisty, and it's always fun to play. And then Knox, he's just going to go after Chris. Mm-hmm. She's the girl of his dreams. Dalton... He's playing the saxophone because his parents made him play the clarinet and he hated it. So he's just going to play the saxophone, man, in the cave. And then Mr. Keating also makes Todd improvise a poem in front of class with his eyes closed. Because, mm-hmm. You know, he wrote a poem. They were all supposed to write a poem. And Todd wrote the poem, but he threw the poem away. And mm-hmm. Mr. Keating was like, nope, you're getting up here and you're doing this poem. And I know that this, you know, assignment scares crap out of you, but you're going to get up in front of the class and you're going to do this. And he makes him do it. Because, you know, being in this Dead Poets Society club means that you get stirred up about things. Knox calls Chris mm-hmm. on the phone and she invites him to her boyfriend's party. Mm-hmm. But it's okay because that meant she was thinking about him. Dalton shows up to the Dead Poets Society with some middle-aged housewives.
No.
Oh, they were middle-aged housewives?
No.
Because they looked like it.
Well, that, every girl looked like a middle-aged housewife in this movie. But yeah.
Makes the rest of the boys very uncomfortable. Things are going off the rails a little bit. And interspersed with this is the scenes of Knox going to that party that he got invited to. Mm-hmm. And I turned to you and I said, see, you let ladies in and it all goes to hell.
Yeah, it was very much a male bonding thing. And then, Dalton was like, oh, I'm gonna get... So he starts quoting some of the poetry they've been reading and he just acts like he wrote it for the girls. Yeah. One of the things established in the movie is we learn English and we learn poetry to woo women.
Gosh, I was uncomfortable and I wasn't even in that cave with them. I was like, oh, Jesus. Meanwhile, Knox is at the party and Chris is there with her boyfriend, Chet. And so there's nothing really else to do. So he gets drunk, even though he doesn't really want to. And he finds himself on the couch next to Chris. And she's kind of passed out, and he takes the opportunity to seize the day, which I don't think carpe diem equates with sexual harassment. He caresses her head and kisses her on the forehead, and Chet sees it and punches him in the face.
As makes sense.
So now back at the cave, Dalton has declared himself new Wanda and says that he snuck an article into the school paper about how girls should be allowed at Welton. And
yeah, signed the Dead Poets Society, even though the Dead Poets Society wasn't in on it. He just wanted to write it.
Right. And so then they're all freaking out because they're like, oh my God, we're going to get in so much trouble. And they do. The headmaster wants to know what's going on with the information, and Dalton refuses to give up the information. So we get spanked because he won't turn his fellow deadheads in. So the headmaster warns Mr. Keating about encouraging the boys to think for themselves because his whole thing is, you know what, just get them to college. And what we've been doing for hundreds of years is working. Just get them into college. And then Mr. Keating goes and visits Dalton, and he's kind of like reprimanding him just a little bit. And Dalton is like, well, I thought you would like it. And he's like, you know, you don't want to get kicked out of school and miss a golden opportunity like being in my class.
Robin Williams knows that they are very lucky to be there, but don't get kicked out.
Right. Neil has been rehearsing for Midsummer Night's Dream this whole time. It's the night before the opening night of the show. And his father shows up and tells him, he found out that he was in the play. And he says, you need to drop out of the play. I don't care if it's opening night tomorrow. And parents like this drive me crazy because it's not all about your kid. It's this project that everybody is involved in. And if you don't do your part, if you don't show up, you're not just bowing out and it's too bad for you. It's the whole production is in jeopardy now because of you trying to pull your kid out.
Yeah, but I mean, again, from the father's perspective in this case, it's like this is his one shot for his kid to get into Harvard.
Yeah.
And so that's going to supersede everything. So, yeah. But they do establish the argument they do establish is that Neil was like, look, I can't do this to everybody else. Plus, I'm getting A's in all my classes. Right, so, right. Like, there's no reason.
His father is rather unreasonable. So Neil goes and talks to Mr. Keating about it. And Mr. Keating is very clear, like, you know, this is going to be a really tough conversation to have, but you need to have this conversation. You have to tell him how you feel and what you think. And Neil's just like, he knows, like, his dad doesn't care what he thinks and how he feels, and it's going to be no use to talk to him. So the next day, he sees him in class, and he's like, oh, did you talk to your dad? And Neil's like, yeah, I talked to my dad, and he's not very happy, but he's going to let me do the play. He's going to be out of town anyway. And I was like, what?
Yeah. Yeah, and Robin Williams' look on his face, too, was like, I don't know if I believe you.
Kind of in between this, Knox visits Chris at her high school. He shows up and she's like, what are you doing here? Get out of here. And he's like, I'm really sorry that I touched you and I was a jerk and I have these flowers for you. And she's like, I don't want them. And he's like, well, you know, she goes into her class and he walks into her class after her and he starts reading a poem about her. Not well received, but you know what? He did it.
We're not encouraging you to do that. But yes, he did.
He's seizing the day. He's carpe dieming.
He is completely stalking in a parasocial relationship, but yes.
It's opening night, and all of the boys are getting ready to go see Neil in the play. And Chris shows up at the school, and she says, hey, you need to knock it off. Chet's going to kill you. And you know what? I don't even care about you at all. And he's like, well, I don't believe that you don't care about me, because if you didn't, then you wouldn't come here to warn me about Chet. And he's like, you gonna go to the play with Chet? And she's like, Chet, go to a play. And he's like, go to the play with me, and if you still don't like me, then I'll leave you alone forever. Which, yeah, right. I don't believe that for a second.
Well, I kind of do. But again, it's such a 16-year-old move. You're going to fall madly in love with me because I go to plays and Chet doesn't.
The play's going really well. And then we see Neil's dad. He comes in, and he's standing in the back, and he's got a scowling look on his face. And Neil's kind of looking out into the crowd, and he notices his dad. Does his dad know that he's in this play? Was he honest? I don't know. He looks pretty mad. Neil looks pretty worried.
He has resting dad face. Yes. So you can't tell. It's like...
I was very proud of him that he did not pull a mom from Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead and yell,
yeah, we're about
you're
to
in
go...
big trouble, young man.
Yeah, we're about to get to that. In the middle of the play. Yeah.
But anyway, so the play, it happens. He does a really good job. Everybody's like super psyched and happy. And Neil's like, oh God, I gotta go talk to my dad. Dad practically drags him out, takes him home, and tells him he's no longer going to Welton Academy. He's gonna go to military school, and he's gonna go to Harvard, and then he's gonna go to medical school, and he's gonna be a doctor.
And then he can do what he wants.
And then he can do whatever he wants. And Neil almost tells him what he feels and what he thinks, but he doesn't.
This isn't just, hey, I want to be in a play. Like, from the beginning, Neil kind of a little bit is like, I want to be an actor.
Right, right, right.
Clearly, this is the only thing he wants to do. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and he's proven it.
Yeah.
You know, he got the lead role and he absolutely nailed it.
His mom tells him he needs to, you know, go off and go to bed, get some rest, because that'll fix everything. Because that's the only thing moms can do in the 50s, apparently, is feed you and tell you to go get some rest. He goes to his room. He takes his shirt off. And he opens the window, and he's standing in this, like, snowy night. And I was like, he's being weird. Is he going to kill himself?
Yeah, as the puck crown on with a beautiful shot with the snow coming in with the...
He puts it down.
And he puts it down.
Acting weird. Goes downstairs and gets the key, unlocks the locked drawer, and I turned to you, and I said, this is why you don't have a gun in the house. And we don't see it.
Nor hear it.
Nor do you hear it. But the dad wakes up and is like, what was that noise? And goes downstairs, and all we see is, like, his hand around a desk, and we realize that he has killed himself. Of course, we have to blame Mr. Keating. It's not the parents' fault, because he put him up to thinking for himself and seizing the day, and he's directly responsible for this suicide. And all the boys find out that he's killed himself. Todd is really upset about it. He's very conflicted. So they're all just like, okay, now we're in trouble. Like, now, we can't stay silent about the Dead Poets Society. And Richard's gonna rat us out. We just know it. And so they go to meet, you know, to kind of strategize. And Richard's not there. And they know, oh my God, he's totally ratted us out. And so Richard is like, you know, they're not after us. They're after Keating. So all you have to do is just tell them everything. And if you're smart, that's what you'll do. But Dalton just can't take it. And he's just angry. And so says that he's gonna punch Richard in the face. And Richard's like, you better not, because you'll get expelled, you know, for that. Does it anyway, gets expelled. And I think he probably did it on purpose so that he wouldn't have to do what all the other boys end up having to do. They each get called in separately with their parents sitting there glowering at them.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a statement basically saying that, you know, it's Keating's fault and it's not your fault and you need to sign this. And so we don't go in with everybody, but we do follow Todd in. And Todd realizes that everybody else has signed this document and his parents are glowering at him and the headmaster is just staring at him. And he realizes, like, there's no way I can do anything but sign this paper.
It is such a well-written scene, because going into the office, the kids are giving, you know, a thumbs up and, hey, of course we're not going to rat. And he looks down and everyone else has signed.
So then the headmaster takes over Mr. Keating's class. So we're the first day back without Mr. Keating. And he, of course, wants them to open to the introduction that has been ripped out.
That's a great scene, yeah.
And Mr. Keating shows up to collect his personals. And Todd is having an anxiety attack in his chair because Mr. Keating is there and the headmaster is there. And Todd just feels so guilty and horrible.
Yeah, and Keating, as he's looking at things, like, he's wanting to say something, and Keating just gives him a smile and it's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah.
So this is the part that made me cry.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Keating goes to leave and Todd goes, Mr. Keating, I'm so sorry they made us sign it. And he goes, I know, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the headmaster's like, stop it, be quiet, you get out of here. And so Mr. Keating goes to leave. And so Todd jumps up on his desk and he yells, oh, Captain Mike. Sorry. Oh, mm-hmm. Captain, my cap. And not all the boys, but a lot of boys jump up on their desks and send the yellow Captain, my captain.
Yeah, you can tell who the main characters are because, like, Knox says, because they get the real moments. In the original script, Richard was supposed to stand on his desk. When they got to that scene, Richard said, "I don't think I should stand on my desk." And the director said, "You know what? You're right. You shouldn't."
So then the last scene is just all the boys standing up. Did he say thank you? Did Mr. Keating say thank you?
I think he said thank you, boys.
Because he had came there and did what he was supposed to do.
If the kids aren't deafened after taking your class, then what the heck are you doing?
So. Oh, my God. So that's the part that made me cry. I didn't cry, like, until that part.
So iconic. Iconic. Yeah, another cool side story of that is the first time they did that, Robin Williams start crying.
and they
cut because the director was like, "No, you can't cry." Like, that's like, everybody who watches this
is going to
be crying.
You can't cry.
But you've got to be there for the boys. And then your character, of course, falls apart when he's in the car. But he can't. He's got to be strong for the boys. So
that's the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know this. I am not particularly an Ethan Hawke fan, but I loved him in this movie. I thought he did such a good job of having all this pressure on him and just kind of wanting to be left alone. And also, you know, having all the anxiety and whatever other, like, issues that he was having, whether it be dyslexia or not, or stutter or not, or mm-hmm. social anxiety, or
just like, burden of pressure of his perfect brother.
Right. And he did such a good job of just, like, not really knowing who he was and being comfortable in his own skin.
He got a call a week after the movie finished wrapping, and he was like, "Who's this?" And he said, "This is Robin Williams's agent." And Robin Williams said, "I need to call you and represent you." And Ethan was floored because he thought Robin didn't like him because he was staying so committed. So he never laughed at Robin's jokes. He never, you know, so Robin.
So he was pulling a Daniel Day-Lewis. So he did a really good job. An interesting thing that we noticed in the credits, Lara Flynn Boyle is credited.
Twice.
And I was like, what? When was that? And so I looked it up. And so I was like, Chet's sister? We didn't ever see Chet's sister. And so I looked it up and her scenes were deleted. And I didn't know that you got to be credited twice if your scenes get deleted.
That's why you have an agent. What did you think of the actor who played Neil?
It's funny that you asked that because as I was watching this and as I was watching him, like, shirtless walking down the stairway and realizing, like, how, like, little he was and, like, he's a little boy. I don't know. Boys that age, typically, they're just kind of idiots, right? I was so impressed with a lot of them because they're so young, having a point of view and being the characters, not acting, but, like, being these characters, which I guess that age is very close to probably who they are. I was really impressed with the quality of their performances.
And the director actually had them, like, live together for a few weeks, like, in dorms and, like, act like, and, like, kind of take classes together and to establish
that.
The
thing you do'd them.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. Watching it, I just felt like Neil overreacted the first kind of pass. But then as I thought about it, I mean, that was an overreaction. But as I thought about it and as we're talking about it, I realized, you know, it didn't matter what he thought or what he wanted or what he had to say. His dad was never going to change his mind or let him be who he wanted to be. So even though he was told he should talk to his dad and even though he almost tried to talk to his dad.
The writer knew that the Neil character had to die to tell the narrative arc he wanted.
Right.
But he was desperate not to inspire kids to commit suicide.
Yeah.
So,
well, because I could see how this movie would be like, you know, the Catcher in the Rye book, right?
Yeah.
Like, I live my life by that.
The story he says is he went to a child psychologist and said, "Look, I need this character to die.
How do
and
I do
it? I need to do it in a way that's not going to still." So that what the psychiatrist came back to was he said, "Okay, the best way to do this is the kid can't have his stand up to his parents moment. He can't have that heroic
failure.
He can't. So there's always that thing of, God, if he had just talked to dad.
Yeah. Talk to your parents.
The one part of the movie that really didn't age well to me was that horrible love story between Knox and Chris. I wish they would have given Chris more.
I wish
they would have established, like, she was at dinner with him, and not only was she beautiful, but we totally talked.
See the connection that they make or don't make.
Yeah.
So the movie is at times a bit overdramatic. It is a little slow in parts. I don't know if that's because I'm a girl.
I do have to approve the soccer portions. The type of ball and the style of kicking and all of that is how it was done. Accurate. It was all accurate for the time period.
I felt like this movie was really well written.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like there were really nice humorous moments kind of peppered in so that you don't want to kill yourself. I love Robin Williams. But again, this isn't a type of movie that I normally would watch because A, it's going to make me cry or try to make me cry. And B, it's all about boys and I'm not a boy. But as we're kind of talking about it, I am kind of realizing that, you know, it is a really well-made movie. So I'm going to have so now the rating system that we should use.
One of the funny parts about the movie is they say you rate poems based off of
importance
and execution. So we were joking about we should make one thumb importance and the other one execution.
So on the x-axis and the y-axis, I give it 2 x's and 2 y-axes. Now, I'm going to give this a thumb in the middle. This movie was not made for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that it was a very well-made film. It was entertaining. It made me kind of cry. It made me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
It made me think.
Mm-hmm.
It made me upset because I felt like, oh, just talk to your parents. So all of the things you're saying that the screenwriter was worth going for had that effect on me. So I'm going to have to give it a thumb up. So one in the middle and one up.
Nice.
2 soccer balls to the side.
This would either be my favorite or like very close to my favorite Robin Williams. Well, what would be your favorite Robin Williams? If this is only thumbs up and thumbs in the middle.
Favorite Robin Williams role.
I think I would have to, the one I think you're going to say is I think you're going to land on Good Will Hunting.
I haven't seen Good Will Hunting.
What? We are seeing Good Will Hunting.
Isn't that Matt Damon.
Matt Damon. We are totally seeing Good Will Hunting now.
No, I don't want out.
And we're back.
Yeah, we did take a short break. I don't know if you could hear the glass crashing from where you were.
But everything's okay. But there was some mess we had to clean up. And everything's okay. No one's hurt.
The biggest mess I've ever cleaned up in my life. It had to do with candle wax. But not normal candle wax. It was soy candle wax.
But the good news is our daughter's okay. Nothing's permanently damaged. And before I asked you, what's your favorite Robin Williams movie? Because Dead Poets Society was basically is my favorite all around Robin Williams performance. Mm-hmm. So what were you going to say?
Okay. Well, you're going to have a fit.
Okay.
I have a couple answers for you.
Okay. It's Robin Williams. So I'll accept it.
I freaking love, I know it's stupid, but mm-hmm. I love that movie RV.
Oh my gosh.
I made you watch it, right?
Yes.
So we can't do it for can't the show because I already made you watch it. I saw that on an airplane coming back from Europe and I was cackling out loud and people were looking at me because I was laughing so hard. So that's just like a silly one, but he does have tender moments in that one.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, I would say all around probably The Birdcage.
Oh, I was gonna ask about that. Mm-hmm. I do agree that it's you get his manic, you get his acting,
you get
a lot. Yeah, so that's a really good answer. Yeah,
yeah.
I loved him in The Birdcage. Yeah. So
and I love that movie.
Yeah, I do
too. Too bad we can't do that.
Yeah.
I love Hank Azaria in that movie.
Yeah, so many good performances in that movie. So
would probably, if you had me my what is it, moth to the flame? No.
Held your feet to the flame.
If you held my moth to the flame.
Then it would die.
I would say The Birdcage.
Okay. So, Corey, what are we going to watch next week?
So, next week, I'm very excited. You get to watch Bedazzled. And it's not the 1960s Dudley Moore Bedazzled. It's the Brendan Fraser, Elizabeth Hurley version.
All right.
And I love the movie. It's just, It's got so many fun scenes, and I would love to be in a movie where you get to play different types of characters, because, you know, Brendan Fraser gets to play, like, so many different types of characters.
Oh, so you're saying we should watch WandaVision together, is what you're saying, since they do that over 8 episodes?
No. You had me watch one episode.
I did.
Still don't know what was going on.
Okay. Kind of par for the
although
course.
Although it did make me go, why isn't Elizabeth Olsen just playing Michelle on Fuller House?
That's true.
That's the conclusion I came to. I am less than thrilled about what I have to watch, because I have thus far been able to dodge this. From what you've said, the theme that I kind of am thinking of is the things that we do for love.
I'll say you'll need to pay close attention to the actors in this one. And the one we're talking about is Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Mm-hmm. It's a partial superhero movie, but not at the time. It has so many ties to future superhero movies that won't make sense until you've seen those superhero movies. So cool. Well, thank you very much. If you would like to get more of this, of course, listen to whatever way you're listening to it now. But
yeah, we can say that now.
Like us.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Like us and subscribe to us and review us on Apple Podcast and Stitcher and Spotify and
all those ones.
All the ones.
Google Podcasts
and Anchor, of course.
Yeah. And if you want to check out all the extra work that I do that takes me all afternoon.
You love it.
I do. You can check out our Facebook page, He Saw, She Saw. And we also have an Instagram page, He Saw, She Saw Podcast. So, yeah, thank you so much for listening, you guys.
Talk to you next week when we'll be discussing Bedazzled and Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
I'm right on top of that, Rose.